In the coming week, World Food Day is marked as global food insecurity rises. NATO defense ministers convene in Brussels, and a Libya in turmoil notes the 10th anniversary of Gaddafi's assassination. It's October 14th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, World Food Day is this Saturday, October the 16th. Food insecurity is a global issue. Millions of people around the world don't have enough to eat. So as World Food Day is marked, people are asking questions like, how do we build local food systems for displaced communities? How sustainable are our current food systems given climate change? How has COVID-19 increased food insecurity? Do we actually have answers for these pressing questions?
Those are indeed pressing and huge questions, Jim. Some of them have been with us for many years. Some, like the COVID-19 one, obviously is a new phenomenon. I guess for starters, we could say partially there's an understanding to how some of those questions are being addressed and can be addressed. You know, taking a bigger view of, say, you know, last half century, there's a good story to tell about food supplies and food security, and that it's improved drastically around the world. And the so-called Green Revolution is among the things that have led to more crops and more food being produced in the world. But the numbers of people who are dealing with food insecurity and food scarcity are pretty staggering, and they're growing. I'll cite a few numbers just to give you a sense of scale, Jim. And some of them are as of 2019 or just before the pandemic. Some will include the pandemic. So up to and including the pandemic now, Jim, the estimates are that almost 700 million people are hungry. That is about 9% of the world population. And that's up 10 million people in 1 year and up 60 million people in the past 5 years. There's another category of people that involves 135 million who suffer from acute hunger, largely due to a whole series of things, that some of which you mentioned, Jim. That's conflicts, it's climate change, economic downturns. And then there's a large block of people who are not in a category of having access to regular, safe, nutritious, and what's called sufficient food. And in 2019, that figure was 2 billion. So that was before the pandemic hit. You had 2 billion people in that area of sort of not being in a position to really know where your next, you know, safe, nutritious meal is coming from. A lot of it is Asia and Africa, but as we've seen in the pandemic, and as we've seen right here in the United States, the lines for food kitchens, for food banks have increased and have stayed pretty lengthy. And the global supply chain situation has gotten more tenuous for foodstuffs, among other things. So it's a good time to be marking this global day. It's where you have the big UN agencies that are in charge of food issues really sort of drawing a line under what's needed. But there's a whole bunch of different things going on here, Jim. And I think the food system aspect, in terms of just creating systems devoid of the question of conflict and civil insecurity, just creating systems by developed world countries that have access to food is going to be the area that I think you're going to see a lot of focus on.
Bob, I'll just note that the Food and Agricultural Organization, which is part of the United Nations system, has some very good data and graphics outlining the growing problem of food insecurity. And one of the things that's striking in looking at the data, if you were to go back 5 years ago, you would have told a very optimistic story that the numbers were going down and had been going down for quite a while. And now they've gone up, particularly since the beginning of the pandemic. Do you have a sense, Bob, of the steps that are being taken either in national capitals or in multinational organizations to address the growing problem of food insecurity?
Jim, I think it's a combination of things. It is doing things like taking advantage of the World Food Day by the FAO, by the World Food Program, and other and NGOs that are locked in with those UN agencies to make sure that, first of all, the haves, the country that have reliable and stable supplies of food, are able to continue to contribute either direct foodstuffs or money to purchase that locally, which is another big issue. And we've heard this repeatedly, that it's not just about sort of showering grain on countries that are impoverished, but actually creating ways in which they can cultivate their own, you know, their own food sources locally. And that also employs people regionally and so forth. There's a knock-on effect. But it's hard to have that sort of knock-on effect if you're dealing with conflict, Jim. And I'll just note, it's kind of revealing to note that of the 10 worst hunger crises in 2020, I'll sort of run down the countries involved, and we can talk a little bit about where they stand today. All of them will be familiar: Afghanistan, Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Haiti, Nigeria, South Sudan, Sudan, Syria, Yemen, and Zimbabwe. Many of those are involved in crises or conflicts that have only gotten worse, or at least have been status quo since 2020. And so it gives you a sense of the challenge here, which is that these are places that food has got to be brought to under emergency emergency circumstances, creating special aid convoys, creating potentially special UN Security Council resolutions to open up aid corridors in places like Syria or Yemen and places like that. So it's this complex, you know, combination, Jim, of like diplomacy of crisis management, and then sort of the broader issue of trying to make sure that the inexorable impacts of climate change are mitigated by, you know, sort of playing off that. So I guess on the latter, to answer your initial question, I think climate change offers at least a chance to get some time to find alternatives to growing food that may be more resilient to hot weather, for example.
Well, but on that, there's, I think, good reason to be pessimistic. We have seen a lot of talk about addressing climate change. We haven't seen commensurate action. Another big meeting coming up next month, COP26, Conference of Parties. It'll meet in Glasgow. It'll talk about climate change issues, probably a lot of talk about its impact on very vulnerable countries, both countries like the ones you just described that have been prone to conflict, but also to other poor countries, which are seeing right now changes in their weather patterns, either less rainfall, too much rainfall, extreme events, which disrupt generations of agriculture and make it very difficult to produce. And again, overlaying this is that the tendency in many countries to focus on particular kinds of farming to be able to sell into global markets, and some of those products may be jeopardized by what we're seeing with climate change. One of the examples that people often talk about is, I think it's coffee rust in Central America, which has really harmed coffee production, which is a major product in the region. It earns hard currency, the sort of things you need to buy food and other things you're importing from abroad.
That's a great example. The coffee rust problem and other related problems have contributed to the, you know, the spike in migration out of some of the Central American countries where coffee has been a cash crop for years. And so you're absolutely right. That's going to be a focus, and it is on the agenda at the COP26 talks. There are places like, you know, come back to one of the ones I mentioned in sort of the top 10, Afghanistan, where, you know, not only do you have, you know, Taliban taking over and sort of this drastic halt in the aid that was sustaining the country, but then you have, you know, Afghan farmers who have already been moving away from what had been illicit cash crops, maybe seeking more comfort in the regularity of opium poppies as a way of keeping revenues coming in, as opposed to, say, growing pomegranates or almonds or some of the other things that Afghanistan is known for traditionally in agriculture. So I think that was something, you had 20 years of the international support for that sector trying to wean them off of opium. And even outside of Taliban control, that was difficult. Under Taliban control, that's going to be yet more of a challenge. And there are increasing calls of concern about Afghanistan facing a really severe food crisis.
Well, this takes us, Bob, back to a core problem that even if climate doesn't disrupt agriculture, even if conflict doesn't disrupt agriculture, problems of insufficient governance, bad governance, absence of governance can make it very hard to both grow crops and to be able to distribute them. And that is a problem we see around the world. And the challenge for us is wealthy countries haven't seemed to be very good at fixing poor countries that have a lack of governance, of sufficient governance. And that's been a big challenge. And this has been true in places where the United States, the European Union have invested huge sums of money. And it is a real challenge.
Yeah. And you're talking about something that is not by any means a light switch that you flip, but really something that's going to take time and painstaking trial and error to get that right. And another topic we've talked about quite a bit on this podcast, which is the backsliding of democracy, is not boding well for that area as well. Democracy, for all its flaws, still being a path towards trying to right the governance flaws.
And I should note the countries that are facing the greatest food insecurity around the world these days are also the same countries that are being hit very hard by COVID-19. We still have the problem of the vast inequality in terms of vaccine distribution. Vaccines are widely available in wealthy countries. They're almost non-existent in lower income countries. I think I've seen numbers saying on average, perhaps less than 10% of the population in these countries has had any kind of vaccination for COVID-19. And of course, these are countries that also lack robust public health systems to take care of people who do fall ill.
Again, there's a through line to that in so many other development areas, Jim. But while we're on the topic of wealthy countries, many of them tend to assemble in Brussels for various international organization meetings, and NATO is one of them. We have a NATO defense minister meeting coming up, Jim, that has a rather crowded agenda, shall we say. You could say that the discussion of strategic autonomy, to cite a big issue, or the recent trilateral AUKUS grouping. This is the Australian-US-UK defense agreement, all of which sort of sets a tone for some strained transatlantic ties. So Jim, what do we need to know about this meeting in Brussels and what should we expect?
Well, I should say up front, Bob, that NATO, to the best of my knowledge, has not issued a formal agenda for the meeting. But I suspect that all the issues you mentioned will be in the background, if not in the foreground, as discussions take place at NATO headquarters. Now, earlier this month, Secretary of Defense Austin met with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. And during the public portion of the meeting, Secretary Austin noted something that's worth keeping in mind. He said, and I quote him, "NATO's power comes not just from its military might, but from its unity and sense of common purpose," end quote. At this meeting, we're going to get a chance to see just how much unity and sense of common purpose there is. And I think it's important to flag this because when we talk about NATO, Bob, we often talk about it as an it, but it's really a they because it is an organization composed of 30 countries with similar but not identical interests. And in the fall of 2021, some of those differences are really showing. The most notable one is one that you mentioned, which is France's displeasure over the AUKUS deal. This has given more wind to the French call for strategic autonomy, that is, the ability of Europe to act on the global stage independently of the United States, particularly in military affairs. And I think the French position has gotten some support elsewhere in Europe, particularly because of the unilateral way the United States went about negotiating and announcing the deal. But you also have many countries in NATO that remain irritated with Washington over how the Afghanistan withdrawal was announced and conducted. Remember, the Biden administration did not do a round of consultations with countries that had citizens on the ground and had troops on the ground. It merely notified them of its decision. And obviously, the withdrawal was chaotic, and that's led to a lot of concern in Europe, I think elsewhere, about American credibility, but perhaps even more important, about American competence or the Biden administration's competence. Remember that when the Biden team came into office, one of its selling cards was that it was a team of experienced foreign policy and national security veterans who wouldn't have the same kind of jumbled, mistake-prone policy of its predecessor. And I think for a lot of people in Europe in particular, I think they're wondering about whether Biden can get the job done. But it's not just divisions between Washington and Europe. You have Baltic countries that are worried that their fellow European countries aren't sufficiently tough when it comes to dealing with Russia, while you have countries like Italy and Spain that think that NATO's policy toward Moscow is too tough. We sometimes talk about Turkey. It has significant differences with the United States and many NATO members. Those differences are deep and go well beyond military matters. But it's also important to point out that not everyone is unhappy with Washington. AUKUS certainly gave the British a chance to reaffirm their special relationship with the United States. It is notable that Berlin did not rally to Paris's side on AUKUS, perhaps because President Biden dropped his opposition to Chancellor Merkel's Nord Stream 2 pipeline deal. That is a deal that may yet come back to haunt Europe, given how it is making Europe more dependent on supplies of gas from Russia. So we'll see what comes out of the meeting. But even if the meeting makes no news, if everyone comes out and smiles and shakes hands at the end, these underlying tensions and divisions are going to continue.
Jim, I think you sketched it out pretty comprehensively. I mean, it's all those issues are on the table, and it is going to be a question of do they conclude with a NATO defense minister meeting in seeming harmony, or is it just too much strain and it's going to bubble over in some sort of inevitable interview with a, you know, European publication that in which people share candid, frustrated comments or so forth. I did think it's interesting to note that in previous NATO meetings, and I'm talking about both summits and other meetings, there has been more and more talk about sort of China and what is NATO's position vis-a-vis China. China is obviously a major pretext of the AUKUS agreement. Do you see that as something, again, we don't have a formal agenda up, but do you see that something that sort of is inevitably going to come up and become even prominent?
Well, Bob, here's where my observation about NATO being a they rather than an it becomes critical. Because on the issue of what steps NATO or the West generally should take in dealing with China, there's significant division because countries have different interests and feel different levels of threat coming out of China. I think it is safe to say that many European countries don't see China as a major military threat to Europe or to themselves, which colors how they approach things. They view it more as a challenge for the United States. And I think in many European capitals and many European publics, there's a great deal of concern about the U.S. approach approach to China. They doubt both its wisdom and its likelihood of succeeding. But a number of public opinion polls that have been conducted suggest that many Europeans don't want to get involved in a tussle between China and the United States. And they think that the United States is a declining power and a rising power. So that colors these assessments. That said, there are a lot of Europeans that think that Europe has a lot at stake in China's rise and could be deeply harmed by a variety of Chinese behaviors, not just in the economic realm where its sort of predatory mercantilist policies pose the same kind of threat to European economies and businesses as they do to the United States, but also in terms of China's handling of human rights issues and its authoritarian tendencies and the kind of surveillance technologies that it is providing other countries and its lack of action in dealing with climate change. So you have those issues on the other side of it. And the big question mark in all of this is Germany. Where does Germany go? We just had German elections. Germans have not yet formed a coalition government. May take until Christmas or later for that to happen. But who's in that coalition government is greatly going to affect what Germany decides on all of these issues. And again, if you look at Germany, if you look at the Green Party, they want Germany to take a tougher line in dealing with China because of climate change issues.
And the Greens, by the way, are mentioned in most, if not all, coalition talks at this point.
But other potential coalition partners are very concerned about maintaining good economic relations with China. So there's a big sort of question mark hovering all over this, and that is, where does Germany want to go? Because where Germany decides to go will have a big impact on where Europe wants to go. Go back again to that question. The French have been pounding the table for several years. AUKUS merely gave them more vigor to go after this issue of strategic autonomy. They think that Europe needs to have stronger military might to be able to chart its own path in the world, not be dependent on the United States. There are actually some potential benefits in that for the United States. After all, we for many years as a country have been saying to our NATO allies, you need to spend more on defense. So it's not necessarily antithetical to U.S. interests, even though it's sometimes portrayed in that fashion. But Germany so far has been reluctant to really embrace strategic autonomy. And again, the Germans have not been investing in their military. Their military, in many respects, is falling apart, needs to be modernized. The Germans can afford to make the investment. They've chosen not to. So there's this question of internal German politics, what choices are going to be made, and how that will affect what it is that Europe does. Just one last thing, Bob, I don't mean to go on so long. What's interesting about the AUKUS deal, certainly from the French perspective, is that of all the countries in Europe, France has the biggest stake in Asia because it has territories in Asia. And I think one of the consequences of the way the Biden administration handled the AUKUS deal is that they did weaken the French, and they have created a division that is going to be very hard to stitch up. Doesn't mean it can't be stitched up, but you know, as you know, if you feel you've been disrespected, you've been mistreated, it's really hard to come and work together with others. And so I think the thing to watch for, not just in this meeting, but going forward, is whether or not the Biden administration can re-knit relations with the French, because the French have tended to favor the positions the Biden administration has taken about taking a harder line on China. And it's generally not a good rule in diplomacy or your personal life to offend the people who are most inclined to help you.
So definitely one of the more intriguing NATO defense ministers meetings we've had in some time, Jim.
It certainly does, Bob. But let's change our focus and talk about the Middle East. Next Wednesday marks 10 years since Muammar Gaddafi was killed. But a decade after his killing, Libya remains in a state of chaos. What lessons can we draw from events in Libya, Bob?
Jim, I guess a big one is the standard regime change lesson, which is something that I think the U.S. in particular has been grappling with quite a bit in the post 9/11 period, which is basically careful what you wish for and be ready if those things do in fact happen. So whether it's Saddam Hussein crawling out of a hole that he was hiding in and being hung, and then, you know, Iraq dealing with everything that ensued and the world dealing with everything that ensued, or it's Libya, in which I think people can still remember him being dragged through the streets by mobs and ultimately killed. The blowback can be severe and it can be broad. In case of Libya, the country remains divided. The country is nominally at peace for almost a year and a half since the ceasefire was put in place. There's supposed to be elections, national elections on December 24th, that last report that are hoped will be a unifying exercise. But we're talking about 10 years of a great deal of fighting, a great deal of chaos, disarray, and also of sort of proliferation of weapons, huge amount of armaments taken out of of Libya, and by many accounts have spread across the Sahel region. You have a lot of instability and a lot of violence in the Sahel region in the last 10 years. And then also Libya in kind of the lawless vacuum becoming this transit point for migrants trying to get to Europe. So hundreds of thousands have passed through. Many have died along the way or been mistreated, have been trafficked and so forth. There's still a problem with migrants in Libya. And there's been, at the same time, there's been a crackdown on the European side of the Mediterranean. On the Libyan side, it's still, you still have a lot of people coming from, you know, impoverished African countries or war-torn African countries who have found Libya to be maybe a better option, but still a pretty tragic one at the end of the day for many of them. It's all these things, and it's a question of the international community's role. You had the UN Security Council with the U.S. Forging ahead, you know, sort of endorsing the moves that were going on in Libya, and yet there wasn't really a place to follow up and sort of set in place a government that could actually rule. You mentioned rule of law and governance before, Jim. You know, Libya is lacking that, and now you have a bit of proxy action going on. You have Russia backing the Libyan National Army. You have Turkey backing the Government of National Accord, which is the internationally recognized government based in Tripoli. And so you're going to have this ongoing sort of support of factions if, say, the elections go forward and do not turn out the way one side or the other wants them to. And so, again, a big mess. One of the other main unsettled, you know, Arab Spring countries and potentially reaching a new stage, although that new stage, it's not clear what that's going to be.
As you mentioned the words Arab Spring, Bob, I'm teleported back more than a decade. I can remember the great optimism that people had that the whole course of history in the Middle East was going to be changed and changed in a very positive direction. And we haven't seen that happen. And as you talk about Libya, I'm thinking back and I compare it to Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, we saw the United States make a major commitment to nation building, spend two decades there, and couldn't make anything stick, as we saw with the Taliban takeover within days after the U.S. departure. Libya is at the other end of the spectrum. NATO-backed effort to unseat Gaddafi, but there was very little effort by the United States and particularly by the Europeans, who were the most enthusiastic about the military mission to unseat Gaddafi, to actually make Libya succeed once Gaddafi was gone. Is the lesson here that interventions are beyond our control? That is, once you break a country, it can't be fixed? Or is the lesson that the United States did too much in Afghanistan and Western countries did too little in Libya, and there's a sweet spot in there that can actually work?
That is a great question. It's one of the ones that I think would be a great essay question for a class on international relations, Jim, a college level class, maybe a 300 level class, maybe 400, because it encapsulates the challenges now that countries are facing. I do think the experiences so far in the 21st century in these places, in the post 9/11 world, in particular in the post Arab Spring world, have really chilled the notion of outside countries being some way able to orchestrate benign changes. Yes, they can pressure, and they can pressure in positive ways. Libya itself, you had pressure brought to bear on the Gaddafi regime to divest of its nuclear military program, and it did. It was cited repeatedly as a success, as a way in which you can get a country ruled by an authoritarian to give up a weapon of mass destruction, and it did, and sort of at least abide by some basic international norms that could provide some stability. But Gaddafi was a dictator. He was threatening to kill a lot of people around the Arab Spring period. There was a headiness that you cited going on, Jim, about, hey, there's a real moment here for change, and the people want change. But I think outside powers trying to dictate that have been again and again proven to be, one, you know, misled, and two, inattentive in terms of being able to stick with the program and figure out what's the best course for these countries, especially countries like in so many places in the Middle East that are so divided and that are so many factions. So again, it's what raises the concern about these elections, which seem to be a way out of this status quo that can result in anything, you know, that will be unifying and sort of resilient going forward, Jeff.
One concluding point there, Bob, for any students who are in fact asked to answer the question you posed for a college IR class, and that is Afghanistan and Libya share one thing in common, and that is that there are outside powers that were actively meddling in their politics, seeking to back different sides. We've seen the Pakistanis bankroll the Taliban in Afghanistan. We've seen the Russians and the Turks in particular play an outsized role in Libyan politics. politics. And again, part of the challenge of putting a country back together or keeping a country together is made all the harder if there are powerful countries that are working actively to make the divisions even bigger, even deeper.
And one more element to add on the Libyan side of the ledger is it is a country with enormous energy resources, keeping the interest of maybe more countries than would normally be the case. So again, worth watching. Jim, we've talked ourselves into the audience figure of the week part of the podcast. This is where listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org their audience figure of the week, or use our Twitter poll to choose. Jim, our poll this week yielded the figure Bolsonaro, as in Bolsonaro accused by ICC. Jim, why is this figure significant?
First, Bob, let me begin with a correction. What happened was President Bolsonaro of Brazil was accused at the ICC. He was not accused by the ICC. Here's what happened. A nonprofit based in Austria called All Rise went to The Hague in the Netherlands, which is where the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is based. And All Rise filed a 286-page complaint alleging that President Bolsonaro's failure to protect the Amazon and its peoples constitutes an assault upon the global population because crimes against nature are crimes against humanity. In essence, All Rise is arguing that the ICC should try Bolsonaro, both because he has failed to protect the indigenous people of the Amazon, and because by allowing continued destruction of the Amazon, he is endangering all of humanity. Now, I have to note here that anyone can ask the ICC to open an international criminal investigation. If you go to the ICC's website, you'll learn that more than 12,000 such petitions have been filed. But the fact that such a petition exists doesn't mean the ICC will do anything, even if the ICC does decide to pursue the complaint, and there is no guarantee it will. It would likely take years of investigation before anything happened. And Bolsonaro is highly unlikely to cooperate with any ICC investigation, particularly one that claims a global right to rule on Brazil's stewardship of the Amazon. You might recall that last September in 2020, when the Amazon was on fire, that French President Emmanuel Macron, among others, called upon Bolsonaro to act to save the Amazon. And Bolsonaro's response was basically to tell the rest of the world to take a hike. Brazil is a sovereign country and is not going to take directions from foreign capitals. I think the bigger question about the future of the Amazon rainforest is going to be decided when Brazilians go to the polls a year from now. And the outcome of that election is likely to determine whether you have an administration that is more inclined to protect the Amazon from destruction or more inclined to exploit its resources, even if long-term that is going to endanger the overall health of the planet.
Yeah, and Brazilians themselves, you'll find some divisions in terms of those who robustly favor exploiting the Amazon for its many riches, and many Brazilians have prospered because of that. Brazil is a huge agricultural superpower, really, in terms of its soybeans and cattle and lumber and so forth. But then there's certainly a large number of Brazilians who want to be responsible stewards of the Amazon and see it as this precious God-given resource and treasure, really, that they should be preserving. So you're right, Jim. It comes down to the Brazilians themselves. It is interesting to note, I happen to see most of Bolsonaro's address to the UN because he usually leads it off at the annual UNGA general debate. And he spent a good deal of time portraying himself and his government as stewards of the Amazon, which was very interesting to just see the amount of time he took to do so and raises questions about whether he was trying to respond to international or maybe even a little bit of domestic concern.
I think in all likelihood, he's trying to preempt foreign criticism by getting on the right side of the issue, even if his policies are leading to further destruction of the Amazon or not preventing further destruction of the Amazon. My guess is just based on the kind of politician Bolsonaro is, he's a populist who plays the us versus them card, that he will take a court filing like this and argue that it's further evidence that those people are out there are hostile to the Brazilian nation, want to keep us down, can easily talk about how Europeans have produced far more carbon over the decades than developing countries like Brazil, and now they're asking Brazil to pay the price for the pollution they created, so on and so forth. Again, I think that what happens in Brazil is ultimately going to be decided by the choices Brazilian voters make at the polls. And again, they're scheduled to go to the polls a year from term this month.
And that's our look at the figure of the week and the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Belarusian President Lukashenko and Russian President Putin meet in Minsk, and Turkey's President Erdogan visits Angola.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlin. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge, Charlotte Peterson, Maya Kinn, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be safe out there.